And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Andy Staples Show. As we promised, we're still just talking about football. I know there's other stuff going on. There's a bunch of media days coming up. You got the SEC this week. You got the ACC this week. We will cover those this week. But I have Ari Wasserman here, and we want to talk about games because we're having fun talking about games. We still don't have stakes for our bet on LSU-UCLA. Remember, I'm giving Ari 15 points on that one. So we need something somewhat embarrassing for one of us to have to do if we lose that bet. But Ari, that game, by the way, spoiler alert, we're going to mention that in this week's topic as well. But if you listen to last week's show, I brought this up and I thought this would be something we should explore a little bit more at a later date. And that later date is now. And it's games that change our expectations for one or both teams. These are early season games where we're watching them and we go, whoa, okay, what I thought this team was, it is not. It is something completely different. And the one that always jumps out to me that sort of changed everything for both teams involved in the game was the 2008 season opener in Atlanta between Alabama and Clemson. This was supposed to be Tommy Bowden's best team at Clemson. Nick Saban was going into his second year at Alabama, but they had not been particularly great in his first year. They'd lost Louisiana Monroe. They just made the Independence Bowl. It wasn't like they were a rousing success. Alabama blew Clemson's doors off, and you realized, okay, Alabama is completely different from what we thought. Clemson is completely different from what we thought. And that, of course, that game ultimately led to the firing of Tommy Bowden. And one of the greatest quotes I've ever heard in my life, which was Tommy Bowden to me when I was writing a retrospective on Dabo Swinney's 10th year as the head coach. Tommy Bowden said, "Never lose to Wake Forest on a Thursday," because that will always get you fired. Ari Wasserman, we have a pretty good list of games here for this week, this year. We picked from week one and week two. Week zero, we're ignoring you here. But week one and week two, and Ari, this is the thing I love about the preseason, the offseason, because we get these narratives going, and I love when they just explode right off the bat.
My favorite types of shows that I do with you are the ones where you come up with the idea with just talking to yourself, because those turn out to be great shows. And it's kind of like the same thing with that, right? We are talking and talking and talking, and you know, all it takes is one or two results to change the way that we were viewing the entire offseason. So the idea of looking at these games as potential turning points for multiple teams, I think, is interesting. You know, and the thing about that Clemson-Alabama game, at least for one program, is it changed the way that we viewed the entire program. And I think that some of these games that I'm looking at that you sent over, I feel like certain results of those games might make you feel like, hey, this team in 3 or 4 years might be different. You know, these are foundational games. And I know that, you know, sometimes it's easy to take one result of an early season game and, you know, go completely off track. But, you know, as we get into these one by one, I think it'll send a message pretty quickly about where those programs are headed. So I'm excited to get into this stuff.
Yeah. And the other piece of it is we may have hyped a team up all off season and then that hype is gone. Sometimes for the best, and sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes it's they just played a bad game, and then they come back and end up having a good season. You know, it's interesting because I always think about the Michigan-Appalachian State game and just an earth-shattering event that was, and then the next week they lose to Oregon, and we think, oh my gosh, Michigan season. That Michigan team actually turned out pretty good, actually wound up about as good as we thought it was going to be by the end of the season. But nobody remembers that. We just remember Appalachian State and then the Dennis Dixon Oregon team with Chip Kelly running the offense. So,
but it also turned out that Appalachian State team was also excellent.
Oh, they're awesome. I mean, but they won two national titles in a row.
So no, I know. But like the idea of just what that team actually was, I think that we needed to see them beat a team. And I think that Michigan team turned out to be just a regular average or a little bit above average Power 5 team. And even though
it was a good team. They crushed
10 wins.
Heisman winner Tim Tebow in the bowl game. Yeah.
Oh, I remember that year because that was the year where I was doing a bowl pool pick'em, and that was one of those bowl pool pick'ems where I felt like where you had to put your confidence level up, and mm-hmm. I had my confidence completely on Florida in that game because I think the spread was like 6 points, and I thought Florida was going to blow their doors off, and I had like $1,000 on the line, and Michigan came out and just blew out Florida. And just like, oh my God, I really misread that. But I don't know. I think that Michigan team in general was just, you know, a solid Power 5 team that year. And it kind of opened the doors a little bit about what an excellent FCS team is actually capable of when things are going the right way. Now, I'm not trying to say that wasn't one of the best upsets of all time, but it was an excellent, excellent football team for their level, beating a team that was pretty good for their level, but wasn't 100% what they should have been. And sometimes, you know, as we've seen things like this develop over the, you know, 15 years since that happened or however long it's been, that the names on the helmets aren't always what you get. And I've tried to do my best to sift through that. And sometimes recruiting rankings get in my brain a little bit, as you guys witnessed in some of the losses I had last year. But yeah, certainly I think was a defining moment for college football, not just that season.
Well, and I feel like we got cheated not getting to see North Dakota State, Oregon last year. That would have been a lot of fun because we've seen North Dakota State in a few of those games against FBS schools, but not against what is perceived to be a really good FBS program. And that's what
it would have been great just to see Trey Lance in that environment too.
Oh, it would have been awesome. But let's go back to this year, and we'll start with one which. It's interesting because this is one of those where obviously if the underdog wins, it will change the way we think about both programs. But if the expected result happens, it also could mean one program could be in for a really tough season and a really weird season because it's North Carolina at Virginia Tech. This is Friday night, and this is I feel like it's magnified because it is the best game of the Friday night of the first week. Everyone who cares about college football is going to be watching it, every single person. And what we think is going to happen is that North Carolina is going to go up there and win comfortably. And if that happens, that in and of itself will be a story that you have to follow because then it's Virginia Tech. Uh-oh. Are they ever going to turn it around? Or just Justin Fuente? Or is this it? Is this the best you can hope for?
I think I disagree with you on this one.
Really?
I think because this isn't the way I viewed it when I read your list. My thought process was North Carolina's over-under, if you listen to our over-unders episode.
Oh, if Virginia for the Tech year, wins, it changes everything.
I think the stakes are much higher for North Carolina because if North Carolina goes into Virginia Tech and wins comfortably, that's just the expected result. And the idea of North Carolina turning the corner and actually becoming a force in the ACC goes out the window immediately on a Friday night as the season is beginning. You have to recalibrate your brain on how you view Mac Brown's build. And that's I've been to an away game at Virginia Tech and those guys get loud. Enter Sandman. That's a tough opener for North Carolina. I think North Carolina is a much better football team and I would expect them to win, but I think that for the first time in a long time the expectation is that North Carolina has to win a game on the road like this. And that is completely different from, you know, I'm not so sure I'm as wound up about Virginia Tech side of things as I am about UNC playing with expectations of being really, really good and actually exceeding those expectations or meeting those expectations.
See, I still think now, obviously Virginia Tech wins. That is going to be a huge story. We have to recalibrate our expectations
for
North
both
Carolina.
Programs.
Exactly. We have to say, okay, now is Virginia Tech a contender for the Coastal? Because that North Carolina is the team we think is going to win the Coastal. So big, big, big if Virginia Tech wins. But I still think because remember, North Carolina hammered Virginia Tech in embarrassing fashion last year. That was one of the two games where North Carolina could not be stopped on the ground. And If something like that happens again, the Fire Fuente crowd will be out in force. Remember, there was all that weird stuff right around National Signing Day, the February Signing Day, where they called a press conference, but it was just going to be the AD, and Justin Fuente's buyout just happened to be dropping the day before. And it was like, what's going on here? And they had to send out something clarifying. No, Justin Fuente will be available on signing day. He's still the coach. But that's the part where even if the expected result happens, I think it's still a story. And I think it's still something that we will be following closely, because Virginia Tech is a really good football program. Virginia Tech is one of those jobs that everybody looks at as like, ooh, you know, if I could get there, I could get some guys from the Tidewater area. I could go down and maybe get some guys from DC. I could really get things rolling there.
It's one of those jobs on paper that has all the things in place for you to be very, very good.
It's the weakest division in college football and in Power Five football. You know, all of that is true. And so I do think if the expected result happens, we'll get that. But if the unexpected happens, if Virginia Tech does win that game, it blows up everything we thought about that entire division. And then things get interesting.
What do you think the spread of that game is off the top of your head, not looking at it?
Oh, boy. Okay. Let's see. The last time North Carolina was there, they lost in 6 overtimes. Virginia Tech won. And in the that was the first one where you had to do basically the 2-point conversion penalty kicks. And then last year was that embarrassing just blowout win in Chapel Hill. North Carolina minus 6.5.
It's 5.5. That's close. Okay. But that, you know, it's actually a little bit, it's in that. So when you say comfortably, what do you think comfortably is? By a touchdown?
No, comfortably would be by more than 2 touchdowns.
Because you would like North Carolina in that game, right?
I would, although it goes against one of my rules. One of my general rules is never bet against a home underdog on a weeknight.
Especially in the opener?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's going to be rocking in Lane Stadium.
Yeah.
So that gives me a little bit of pause. That 5.5 seems about – it feels like they've accounted for that, and that's why it's at 5.5.
If North Carolina goes out and wins like even 80% of the way that they won a year ago, that could be the game. Because when you came up with this idea last week when we were doing the podcast, you said games that might be looked back at in 3 years as a transitional game, not just what we view about these teams now. This could be the game where North Carolina arrives with everybody watching them in a loud stadium on the road on a weeknight against a conference opponent to open the season. They go out, they win comfortably on the road in that environment. You know, it might be fool's gold. I mean, we'll find out, you know, 7-6 weeks down the road. But that could also be the game where North Carolina arrives as a really good football team and must watch television in this sport.
And they are a fun team to watch. Just the way they pile up points, the way they'll mix up the run and the pass and in very exciting ways. So yeah, I'm with you there. Our next game is the game that we've talked about multiple times on this podcast that is going to be like the mascot game for our podcast until it gets played, and that's LSU and UCLA. And I think people may misunderstand me when I say that I think LSU is going to win this game by more than 2 touchdowns, and that's me saying that UCLA is going to stink. I don't think UCLA is going to stink this year. I think UCLA will be the best UCLA team Chip Kelly has had in his tenure there. The question is, how good will that really be? And so they've yet to win a non-conference game. You know, we'll see if they can go to Hawaii and win under Chip Kelly. They've yet to win a non-conference game. We'll see if they go to Hawaii and beat the Rainbows on the first week zero. And so that streak may be snapped by the time they play LSU. But this one's going to be interesting because LSU is in this weird spot of, was 2019 a fluke? They can prove it wasn't if these coordinator hires work out, if these players gel together, and they are competitive in the SEC West. If they are not, and I would say losing to UCLA would be a pretty good significant indicator that they aren't, then things get weird. And if you can't beat UCLA, you're going to have a hard time with Texas A&M, Alabama, maybe Auburn, Florida. You know, that this is this is where it gets interesting for them. So I not only do I think they're going to win like that, I think they have to win like that. Or it's just going to be, it's going to be tough.
So you find, which one, which side of this do you find more interesting? Which team?
LSU's always more interesting. You know, UCLA situation is, they could lose this game, and they could lose this game by a lot of points, and it still doesn't necessarily change anything for them. I do think they thought they would have made more progress under Chip Kelly, but they can still make progress under Chip Kelly this year. I mean, you look at last season, they were right there in every single game. I don't think it, you could see the improvement, especially when DTR was back and healthy. You could see the improvement. You could see what they were getting at and what they were trying to do. And so I think they will be better. And I just, will they be good enough to beat LSU? I don't think so. But I do think they'd be good enough to compete in the Pac-12 South and maybe beat somebody they're not supposed to and maybe go above 500 in Pac-12 play, which that represents progress to me.
When did people stop giving a crap about Chip Kelly?
After he turned down the Florida job, took the UCLA job.
Remember when he, not just when he had it rolling at Oregon, but do you remember the Chip Kelly craze that the internet was?
He fundamentally changed the sport.
No, I know, but do you remember the craze that everybody had when he was interviewing for NFL jobs? Like Absolutely. How every NFL vacancy was, we might be the person who gets Chip. And it's just like, I find it fascinating. And I don't know if it's just UCLA as a black hole of indifference, but we're talking about one of the most iconic coaches in recent memory that ran one of the funnest offense, like you said, that fundamentally changed the sport. And he's going into what, year three now, or is this year four now?
This is year four.
And at a Power Five school in California, and maybe that's the sentence there that reveals everything, but I am super curious about UCLA and wonder whether the entire magic that wants to find his name is just gone. Like, is it gone? Or does UCLA have a chance in anybody's mind of ever being a team that can win the Pac-12 and make the playoff? Well, is that just a pipe dream now?
Is he Harper Lee? That's the question. Is Chip Kelly Harper Lee? Does he only have one phenomenal, great book in him, and that's it? Because
that's what I'm asking you. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, at this point, I'm starting to lean toward he's not got this other paradigm shifting thing, and his day to day normal might not be good enough.
Do you think it's because he's not unique anymore?
Well, yeah. He did something that changed everything, and then everybody else changed with it and caught up. So you can either be really good at the day to day stuff, just relentlessly competent, or you can have the one big idea that changes everything. But the thing is, if you have the one big idea that changes everything, you're probably not going to have another one. That's really hard to do. What he did, and it wasn't just college football, he fundamentally changed the sport at every level. So most people can't do that. Most really good coaches will never do that.
Is Harper Lee a genius?
She wrote one amazing book. I don't know if she's a genius or not, but she wrote a book that pretty much everybody has read and loved.
To author To Kill a Mockingbird has to be one of the most intense human accomplishments a human being could ever have.
And the pressure to do it again must be unbelievable.
I sometimes wonder, like, if you take that into the genius that it is to be a college football coach at a successful level and do what Chip Kelly did from an offensive standpoint. Do you think that's one good idea and a one-off, or do you think that that's a genius that can do it again?
Well, because the viewpoint of it, I'm starting to wonder.
Yeah, the viewpoint of it is that he has all the tools that he needs at UCLA to do it again. And he made a lot of hay recruiting Southern California when he was at Oregon And now he's at a place that has closer access to them, and he's not recruiting at the same level. And it's just like the luster of Chip Kelly's name wore off because he wasn't successful in the NFL. And it's like I was just kind of baffled that when he returned to college that he didn't re-step into that cachet that he had. You know, and I think
He had the chance to, and he said, I don't want that smoke. He had the chance to go to an SEC program that expects you to compete for national titles, and he said, no, thank you. I would not like to do that. And I don't blame him because I don't think his personality fits that area and that type of recruiting.
But also UCLA seems to me a much better fit for what he did before to do it again. Like doing what he did at Oregon, it doesn't equate to me at Florida. It's not the same thing. I feel like when he took the UCLA job,
it's happened at Florida. Steve Spurrier did it at Florida.
No, I know, but it's completely different now. I mean, it's not the same thing. I mean, you know that. And
it's changing offense in a whole league that's doing everything differently. And you're like, nah, I'm going to do it this way.
And like Mike Leach is trying to do that now?
No, Mike Leach did that in the Big 12. He already did it. It happened. Now,
I know, but Mike Leach took an SEC job, but I guess it's not one that expects to compete for national championships.
No, and the thing about that is everybody, there's so much tape on the air raid now. It's not like that's new and different. Everybody's seen it, whether they've played against it or not. They can call a buddy who's played against it. Like what Chip Kelly was doing at Oregon, everybody's like, holy crap, how do we deal with this? I've never seen anything like this before.
I feel like Chip Kelly and his rebuild attempt at UCLA has been hindered by the fact that there's no respect on his name.
I don't think that's it. I think people still respect him. I mean, how can you not look at what he did at Oregon? Or how can you look at what he did at Oregon and not respect
him? Why does UCLA's build seem hopeless?
Because the big idea is not there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the idea for UCLA is that you're going to hire a coach that knows how to win at a high level with players that are under-recruited or fit his system perfectly. But if the idea is not there and he's not recruiting at a high level, then what makes you think that this is going to be a big turnaround year for UCLA? It's kind of like, to me, when I look at this game, it's like if LSU doesn't win comfortably in a 5-point spread game, then LSU is the one with the problem and UCLA is going to go on to be kind of okay this year and win 6, 7, 8 games. It's like, that's not interesting to me at UCLA. Like the interesting thing when UCLA hired Chip Kelly was, is UCLA going to be a badass football program with awesome uniforms and be one of the teams that saves the Pac-12 from its demise? And it's like, now this conversation is so boring to me, like about not this conversation, but the conversation surrounding UCLA is boring to me. And it's like, can we get some of that juice back?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that would come with elite recruits, which the part people forget is that Jim Mora got really good players at UCLA. You know, they had first rounders. They had a first round guy in this past draft. He just finished his career at Miami because he got hurt at UCLA. But they had big name recruits that signed with them under Jim Mora and had some success with that. But I would argue you need someone who can do more of that than someone who can just kind of slide these, you know, under the radar. Like, you're in freaking Beverly Hills. You don't fly
under
the radar.
What does UCLA have to do to get Corey Foreman? I'm sorry I'm beating the UCLA drum here, but like, it's just like, what is that?
I don't know. Clay Helton was not that cool either right now.
I thought he was so cool. Yeah.
Clay Helton's not that cool either.
Chip Kelly is the epitome of cool. Chip Kelly is one of four coaches in the history of modern day football that's transformed a program into not cool into cool. Without Chip Kelly, Mario Cristobal isn't putting together top 10 classes. He's just not. And it's just like,
no, you're right.
Oh my God. It's just like, what can we do? I just want UCLA to be good.
Well, beating LSU would be a start.
UCLA is my West Coast Texas, Andy.
But it's not the same because they have not brought in that level of talent. They occasionally bring in somebody like that, but they don't do it consistently.
I mean, they have the juice to be the second best team in the Big 12, but or the Pac-12. But you know, for the sake of our listeners, we can go on to the next game.
No, we're your head might explode. Let's be honest. We'll be right back after these words.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
This next one's interesting. I am really glad the Big Ten has now fully embraced early season conference games. They've actually got a week zero game. They got Nebraska, Illinois, but we're going to start in week one, Penn State at Wisconsin. Now, Phil Steele, our friend, everybody's pal, has Penn State as his most improved team this year. And if you look at last year, I mean, it was anomaly after anomaly. It was as miserable a year as you're going to get. And they did get better as the season went on. So that makes sense as to why you'd think they'd be better. But the thing is, to be where they want to be, which is competing for Big Ten titles, they need to be competitive with Ohio State, obviously. But they also need to be competitive with a team like Wisconsin, which has been consistently probably the second best program in the Big Ten in the last, Penn State and Wisconsin have been duking out for second best program in the Big Ten over the last 5 years.
The only reason why Wisconsin has the claim of that is because they don't play in the East. I think Wisconsin has benefited greatly because they don't play in the East. But I think both of these programs are kind of in similar places right now. You have a Penn State team that's trying to recover from one of the worst seasons they could have even imagined, even a psycho year that it was last year. And Wisconsin had a pretty weak start to the Graham Mertz era, and I think they had some pretty bad COVID issues at one point. But you also thought when Graham Mertz signed with Wisconsin that that was the type of quarterback that that program had been missing to take them to the next level. And Wisconsin signed their first top 25 class last year in the history of their program. So, you know, I know that Wisconsin is what it is. It's a 10-win team annually that feels like it has its trip stamped to Indianapolis every year. I know Northwestern's had something to say about that. Iowa's popped up a few times, but Wisconsin is the king of the West. And you have two teams that are trying really, really hard to get off to a great start after a terrible, terrible COVID year. And the spread is close. The game is in Wisconsin. It's in week one. All the things that you'd want out of this game are there. And I think that both sides are equally interesting in this one, Andy.
So let me give you the key number. The I didn't realize it was this bad. 3.93. That is Wisconsin's per carry average in 2020. That is insane. That is not Wisconsin. That's just, they don't do that. They're better than that. And so, it has to get better. It cannot possibly get worse than 83rd in the country in rushing average per attempt.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see, too, if Wisconsin can stay within itself and not change who they are because they have a hotshot quarterback. And maybe they need to compete at the highest level, but Wisconsin gets to Indianapolis by running the ball down their opponent's throat, not by throwing all over them.
Yeah, and so, okay, if Wisconsin wins this game, I think a close game is probably okay with either fan base, either direction. It's like, all right, these are good teams. It's close. If one team blows the other out, it's panic button time on the losing campus. I think whoever does that freaks out if they lose big in this game.
Which team do you think has more at stake here?
I think Penn State. Because Penn State needs to show that they've turned the corner after last season, and it did seem like things were getting better at the end. And I mean, you go from the way things started with Journey Brown
having to medically retire. And then Noah Kane in the first quarter of the first game out for the season. Like, that's like you have a great running back room that all of a sudden is nothing in a week. Like, that just doesn't happen most of the time.
So, I think I heard on the show with Audrey, too, that they sent their players home and then the Big Ten resumed their season and they missed out on a ton of – Penn State, I think that you can say, had an anomaly of a year. And I don't know if the standard is beating Wisconsin on the road in the opener, but it is, right? I mean, that's what they expect.
It is. And for Wisconsin, it's you've got this hotshot quarterback. He's the highest rated quarterback you ever signed. You had a pretty adequate starter in Jack Cohn, who you've now chased to Notre Dame because the higher rated guy is now in his place. And now they've got to prove they can win with that guy.
I think this is one of the best games in the preseason.
I'm very excited about
this. Even though it's a conference game. But in the early season,
I'm very excited about this one. Now let's go to one that people who are diehard psychotic college football fans, either fans or just degenerate gamblers, this is one that everybody's been on since the schedule came out. But this is when I think the casual fan, if what we think is going to happen happens, the casual fan's going to go, "What the hell just happened?" And that is Louisiana at Texas. Now, Billy Napier's team was excellent last year. The only game they lost was to Coastal Carolina in a just fantastic weeknight game in Lafayette. This team went and thumped Iowa State. Iowa State, which would go on to win the Fiesta Bowl, by the way, thumped Iowa State at home in the season opener. This is a team that brings almost everybody back. I think they've got 21 starters back, if I'm not mistaken. And they're going to play a team with a first-year coach that, while talented, tends to not play well against veteran teams with great chemistry that are well-coached.
We're talking about Texas again. Let's go.
Tell me why Texas wins by 3 touchdowns.
Texas by 70. No, I don't. I don't know that I do want to. Louisiana's really, really good.
They're
a good football team.
Will the Texas fans go nuts if the Raging Cajuns win this game? Because anybody who watched these two teams last year would expect Louisiana to win the game. But will Texas fans go berserk if they do?
Yeah, of course they will. Of course they will. I think the expectation is, at Texas, we have enough talent to compete with anybody in the country, and we finally have an offensive genius, not that Tom Herman wasn't when he was hired, but we have an offensive genius that's going to make our program look the part. And I think if Texas wins by 5, they're going to freak out.
Yeah,
I hope that they're seasoned enough as college football fans to understand that this would be a very, very good team, that they're eking out it's a tough opener for Texas. I mean, it's a really hard opener.
If Texas wins this game, I'm going to be really impressed. Really,
they're
10-point
favorites.
That's insane. I wouldn't touch that.
10 points is insane.
Texas winning this game by
Texas
10 points?
Could win like 28-17 or something.
They could. They could also lose 28-17.
Yeah, I don't know that I would ever lay the points on a first year coach who has a lot to work on. But I think Texas fans have to understand that it's going to be a process and you're not going to see the Vince Young team out there in week one. Like, you know, it's going to be something that they're going to have to, you know, work towards and morph into, you know. And, you know, I expect fully that Texas is going to win the football game, but I don't think it's going to be easy by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think that any of their fans should expect a blowout because it's not, they're not
Texas
playing a
wins
team that's
by one. I'll be impressed.
I anticipate that they'll win the game.
I don't know. I mean, I saw that team go into Ames, and that was a good veteran team that wound up winning a lot of games.
Yeah. No, it happened already last year. Yeah, I agree with you. And that was a team that almost won the Big 12. So, you know, I know, but where would you put Louisiana in the Big 12? Would you say that they're a middle tier Big 12 team right now, the way they're built?
I would say Yeah, I wouldn't say middle tier. I'd say above average. Not a win the conference or play for the conference title, but like a third or fourth kind of team.
Yeah, so, if you put them in that regard, that's the exact team that Texas hasn't been able to beat. So
I know,
you know, yeah. So that's you know, I think it's a very interesting opener for them. But I think the idea,
Ari, this is in basketball terms, this is the mid-major that starts five seniors that have played together since they were freshmen. That's right. Who you're dealing with.
I know. Against a team that it's the mid-major with five starters returning that have played
against a team with two freshman lottery Kentucky, picks.
Yeah, against Kentucky in the first game of the season. I think that's a good way to look at it. I wouldn't touch that game with a 10-foot pole, but my anticipation is that Texas will win the game, and if they do, it should be a nice foundational win. But, you know, the anticipation always was that Iowa State was going to win that game too, and seasoned college football fans who listen to the show and are obsessed with football the way that we are understand the context of this game. And if Louisiana wins, it's not Appalachian State versus Michigan. This is a really good football team.
All right, let's go to Sunday of week one.
I love Sunday.
Notre Dame at Florida State. I put this game on here, Ari. I would assume Notre Dame wins this game. But I don't know, because Florida State is essentially a completely different team than it was last year. This is the test of the transfer portal and the new transfer rules right here. Like, this is how much can you change a team overnight using the transfer portal? And we're going to find out with Florida State this year.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see if Florida State's going to even have a pulse. You know, and I guess they had a pulse last year. That might not be fair.
But they beat North Carolina, but that was pretty much it.
Yeah. And who did they lose to last year in the beginning of the year?
Well, they lost a game. By Miami. They lost to Georgia Tech in the season opener.
Yeah. That's correct. And that was kind of just like, oh, no. But, you know, I think I anticipate that Notre Dame is going to take a step back this year. I think it's something they're going to be a very good football team, but I don't know if they're going to be a playoff team this year. And Florida State, the anticipation is that they'll take a step forward. And I think that's a 10-point spread also. And if I were to bet on this game, I would probably take the points. And I think the idea is Florida State going to turn a corner? Because they've turned a corner in the recruiting realm. I mean, they're recruiting better than, you know, they have in the last 5 or 6 years in the 2022 class, but you want to see that on the field too, to have some faith in the head coach.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know that Notre Dame is probably the better football team and they're probably going to win this game on the road. But I think this will be a very interesting thing just to see the way that Florida State looks early. And it's whether or not it's going to be an entertaining team, a team that's talented enough, you know, even though I have questions about their team talent, to, you know, be dangerous in the ACC. You know, I don't anticipate they're going to win the ACC by any stretch of the imagination, but is this a team that can beat North Carolina again? Is this a team that can play with Florida? Is this a team that, you know, if they're matched up with Clemson, won't get blown out 72-10. You know, it's just kind of, we're waiting to see if Florida State will be the Florida State that we have remembered so fondly. And you were there for the spring game. You saw the talent up close. I mean, is this a team that's built that can win?
It's not a team that's going to compete for titles.
No.
But I don't know what I don't know what happens at quarterback, because there was that moment where you're standing behind McKenzie Milton when he throws just a perfect pass and you're like, oh, that's the guy from 2017 and 2018.
What percentage of that guy is going to be that guy? Is he going to be?
Don't know. No idea. That's the question. Because we don't even know if he's going to win the job. Jordan Travis may win the job.
I know. But if he wins, yeah. It's really hard to view a team when you don't know who their quarterback's going to be. But Milton is one of the things that's I'm most excited to watch unfold. Because it was such a gut-wrenching thing that happened to him. The fact that he's even there, and if he can rip the ball. Because I saw some of those passes in the spring game. And I was like, whoa.
Oh,
you know, if they get a quarterback that can make you say whoa a few times, you know, you might put yourself in a position where you start believing in them a little bit. And if he's their quarterback in week one and they start playing, you know, really, really well against Notre Dame, you might think, hey, this is the hand coming out from the grave, you know, the Florida State hand saying, hey, you know, we're not gone. And, you know, that's kind of what you're expecting under Mike Norvell. And it might be a year or two away, but, you know, Notre Dame is vulnerable in my opinion. And I think they're vulnerable against Cincinnati too. And if they're vulnerable, then this is exactly the type of game where Florida State can come out and say, hey, don't forget about us. Even if it is
everybody's watching, the whole country's watching, but more than anything else, I just want to see, because if Florida State can play well and be competitive against a team like Notre Dame, it will signal to all these coaches, hey, if things aren't working, I can flip my roster now. I can make my team look completely different in a year, because this is a night and day difference than from last year's roster. Let's move on to week two. And I want to start with probably the most anticipated, other than Clemson and Georgia, which we've talked about quite a bit. And obviously we've both said, we don't think either result either way is going to change our opinions much about either team unless it's a blowout. But this is a game
if Clemson
that I feel
blows
like,
out Georgia before you transition.
Oh yeah.
I might be like, what the hell's going on in Athens?
You might bail on them.
I mean, if they get blown out,
I just feel
out,
like they got so many games to make it up afterward, though.
No, I know. I mean, but we're all kind of waiting for Georgia's arrival as a legitimate power in the sport. And I know that they were one overtime away from winning a national championship. But to me, that national championship loss was supposed to signify the arrival of a dominant force. And they have been anything but that in the time since. And they have a chance with a quarterback that should be very, very good this year, and a team that's as talented as anybody in college football to be the Alabama that people think that they should be. And losing to Clemson by a lot would be like very big turnoff. It would just be like, there's something wrong. It might make me feel like there's something wrong there.
Alabama lost by Clemson to a lot and managed to come back. It happens.
No, so. I know. I mean, Clemson's really, really good, but it's just like, when, how long do you go before you start wondering if Kirby can do it on the field?
If they don't wind up close to the playoff or in the playoff this year, there will be that question. That question will be very loud by the end of the season. If
teams have a hard time getting into the playoff when they're blown out.
They do. As Nick Saban once told Scott Van Pelt, if I'd have lost by 5 touchdowns, I wouldn't even be here today. You wouldn't be talking to me. So, all right. But you mentioned the established power and the program trying to become one of those. Well, we've got a game between those in week two. We've got Oregon at Ohio State. And depending on who Oregon starts at quarterback, and we don't know if it's going to be Ty Thompson or Anthony Brown. If it's Anthony Brown, he's played some. If it's Ty Thompson, you could see a quarterback matchup in this game between two starting quarterbacks who entered the season with zero collegiate passes.
Sign me up for that.
Which that adds mystery to it. Look, Ohio State has the better roster. Ohio State has more good players. Oregon has some really good ones, but Ohio State has across the board great players. So the thing that can make it a game is if Oregon has a more special quarterback, and we'll just have to see. We don't have any idea, and I think that's what makes this fun.
I'm rooting for Ty Thompson to win the job. And if you want to hear something funny, both of these quarterbacks were ranked very similarly. C.J. Stroud, who I anticipate is going to win the job in Texas, was the number 42 overall player out of Rancho Cucamonga in 2020, and Ty Thompson, a year younger in 2021, was number 39. And they're both, you know, very big guys that have big arms and are super talented, and it would be very, very fun to see those two guys face off against each other, because I believe that in 2 years from now that those might be the two faces of college football, or two of the 10 faces of college football. And, you know, I don't know if I were a coach how I would handle this, but at a certain point you want to turn the page and get your most talented players on the field as soon as possible and just get that clock rolling on a talented roster to get them developed and seasoned. I don't know if that's the best thing to do when you're playing Ohio State on the road, but the Pac-12 has needed a signature win, and I don't know when the last one was. Like, what's the most significant Pac-12 victory in non-conference play that you can go back to and say, hey, oh my gosh, the Pac-12 is going to be really, really good this year because this team is really, really good. If Oregon somehow goes to Columbus and beats Ohio State, then all of a sudden that entire West Coast sect of football is interesting moving forward.
It would be like when Oklahoma went into Columbus and beat Ohio State, and you're like, okay, Baker Mayfield is,
yeah, right,
is legit, like, could win the Heisman. Could,
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what it would take. And we don't know what Ohio State is, other than we know they will be consistently good at every position, but we don't know what the quarterback is. And Justin Fields set a very high bar. So
he did. That bar's not going to be touched, by the way. It's whether or not Ohio State can get 70% of Justin Fields and still be a national championship contender.
Which, you know, it may be able to do that, given especially given the talented receiver. I mean, they've got a lot back.
Yeah, if you look at what do you think reasonable expectations are for Oregon in this game? Do you think Oregon fans go into this game saying, I think we should win this football game, or are they just hoping for a close game?
I think they're hoping for a close game, but in the back of their mind, they're saying, if we get great quarterback play, we might be able to win this game. And if we win this game, we can make the playoff. Because that, you know, if they win that game, it gives them the mulligan in Pac-12 play. It gives them that loss they can have, and everybody just writes it off and doesn't worry about it, which Oregon's had those. I mean, they lost to Oregon State last year.
Right.
Let's not forget that. You know, they lost to Arizona State the year before in a game they shouldn't have come close to losing. So,
and at a certain point, Mario Cristobal has to get wins on the field.
Yes. Yeah. You got to prove that you can play with these guys. And the thing is, Oregon's not really had a chance to play with these guys. They've made the playoff. So they have not had the opportunity to see this level of talent yet. And so now's their chance. And we'll see what they can do. I'm really excited to see it.
Because I feel like if Oregon goes to Columbus and they lose by a lot, you just almost shut the book on the Pac-12 again for another year.
It would take USC beating Notre Dame and you know, some of these other games. We'll talk about Washington, Michigan in a second. I don't know that Washington, Michigan means much unless Michigan winds up being good. But
why don't we just go into that one now?
Okay, let's talk about that one, because that's one I don't feel like we really got a sense of what the Huskies look like under Jimmy Lake last year because of all the COVID issues and, you know, the just crazy shortened season in the Pac-12. So I don't know what to expect from Washington really at all.
Do you know what to expect from Michigan at all?
No, definitely not. I mean, they are a complete mystery too. So
what the game that I'm most excited to watch in the non-conference is Georgia-Clemson. I think everybody can universally agree on that. But this is a very close second because I like watching games where I sit down in front of the TV and I have no idea what I'm about to witness.
And that's what this is. You really don't. Whatever happens will be a surprise. And I don't know what to expect. Like Phil Steele, I mentioned him before with Penn State. He's high on Washington this year. And I can see that, but Washington beating Michigan in this situation wouldn't be an upset. Do you have the spread in front of you? I'm assuming they've made Michigan like a slight favorite.
Why don't you give me go vamp for a second? And I'll pull the spread up.
Okay. Well, I just don't know. I don't know what Michigan looks like with the massive overhaul of the staff. We think we know what the offense looks like because Josh Gattis is still there, but defensively they'll be different. And we think Cade McNamara winds up starting for them, but we don't absolutely know that.
Why?
And Ari doesn't understand why they don't just go to the freshman.
Just go to the five star. Let him ride, man. I don't know.
Or Michigan, Alan Bowman coming in from Texas Tech if he's healthy.
Yeah, I would try to my best to put the best players on the field, and even if they're not 100% ready, you live and die with that. And if you're Harbaugh, it kind of gives you a safety shield from criticism. I think it's the perfect play. I'm still trying to find the spread here. But I do think that this should be a very good game either way. And I think we're going to find out a lot about these two teams either way. And okay. I'm seeing 7 here. But I think that's wrong.
Michigan -7?
No. Washington -7. But I think that might have been I think that might have been a weird middle of the summer spread.
Gotcha. Well, you know, I can live with that. That actually feels like a more normal. Okay, I'm seeing one book with Michigan -2.5.
Okay, yeah, that
so
was
this
a weird
is, this
line.
This is gonna be all over the map.
Yeah,
it's gonna be all over the map.
I don't know that I would lay a single point if I were betting this game either way. So in my opinion, I think that that's kind of a no touch. I don't have any idea what to expect, but I feel like it's between two programs that are dying for a significant program-defining win. And Michigan's had a few, I think. But if Michigan goes and beats Washington early in the season, I think that you can say, hey, hold the Harbaugh criticism, especially if their freshman J.J. McCarthy's playing at quarterback. I don't know that that's what people are expecting, but that's what I would do. I think it's perfect. I think it's brilliant.
So I don't know what happens here. I don't know. I do think if Washington goes in and steamrolls them, the this is it for Jim Harbaugh gets pretty loud. And you and I have talked about where the line of demarcation might be on this season. It may be the Wisconsin game. But if Washington crushes them, I think probably all hope for anything changing goes away.
Okay, I'm looking at spreads here now.
Okay.
You've got it from Michigan plus one to Michigan minus one. So it's kind of just either way, everybody views this as it's a coin flip.
Yeah, because nobody knows anything. And at least Vegas is admitting they don't know anything with this one.
Yeah, and they just want everybody to let it fly. But, you know, I think this will be very, very interesting, and I think that Michigan has higher stakes than Washington.
I think you're right.
Because Washington's in year two of a new coach, and Michigan's in year 100 with a coach. They're not sure they even want to be the coach.
I would argue this is really year one for Jimmy Lake. Last year wasn't even a year. They didn't get a chance to show what they could do. So I think you're right about that. Let's stay with the Pac-12 here. Stanford at USC. So Stanford loses the first two games last year, wins the last four. David Shaw had basically told his good players, like, go get ready for the draft. Like, he told Walker Little, go get ready for the draft. We don't know what's going to happen here. I got a feeling Stanford's going to be better this year than they were last year, and maybe they were the year before that. Now, Davis Mills is gone, but... And we never really got a chance to see Davis Mills at full strength anyway. But what if they go to USC and beat them? I mean, the fan base is already checked out on Clay Helton as it is. Are we in outright mutiny mode at that point?
Yeah, this isn't very interesting. I don't know. I'm just not that interested in how good Stanford's going to be this year. And they play Kansas State in week
interested
one.
In if they beat. I'm interested if they beat USC. That's what I'm interested
in. Yeah, yeah. USC is... Clay Helton is going to be on the hot seat at some point this year. Like, this is a perpetuating hot seat until they're awesome. So, yeah, of course. This is a huge game for USC because it's early on in the season and you have a conference game right off the bat. And I know they open up with, you know, San Jose State, but that was a pretty good team last year too. So,
yeah,
you know, to me, it's kind of like, last year you basically, and I think I'm going to use this word, you ridiculed me. For thinking that USC before they lost should be in the playoff discussion.
Yes.
But what is it going to take
not very good.
For you to see USC is turning a corner? Because these 1-point wins over Arizona, these close games against Oregon State, they're not going to do it. What you want to see is them to kick the crap out of these teams.
Yes. Good play at the line of scrimmage where they dominate teams with inferior talent. That's what I want to see from USC. And I don't think we're going to see it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been no indication that that is around the corner. And when you look at their schedule, San Jose State, Stanford, at Washington State, Oregon State, at Colorado, their first five games, they should be 5-0 going into a game against Utah. And they could be 6-0 or maybe should be 6-0 because that Utah game is at home going to Notre Dame October 23rd.
And I could make a case where they could have two losses at that point.
But if they're 6-0 and their average margin of win, victory is 6 and 6.5, you're going to just do the same thing you did last year. They suck. Yeah. You know, it's like they have to
gonna,
be.
It's
going
to catch up to them against Notre Dame.
There's a certain expectation that USC has to be sexy.
Well, I don't think it's a matter of they have to be sexy. I think it's a matter of if you're squeaking out those wins, then when you do have to play Notre Dame or when you do see Oregon in a Pac-12 championship game, you're not going to have a chance.
USC schedule, looking at it, they could go undefeated.
They could. They could also go 7-5.
If they go 7-5, then they just suck.
Yeah, I mean, they'll fire Clay
Helton.
That's
not even it.
The middle is more interesting in terms of Clay Helton. You know, if you're 9-3, what happens?
You can go down their schedule though, and you don't see a game that is a 100% loss before they play it.
Absolutely not. Every one of these games they can win. Every
single manageable game every single week. So to me, 10-2 would be pretty good. What does Clay Helton have to do to save his job? I don't know if it's going to be determined against Stanford. I guess what you're saying is if they lose to Stanford or play a close game against Stanford, and it's like, oh, boy, here we go again situation, we're going to know on September 11th when they play at 9:30 on Fox with everybody watching. But I'm just trying to figure out exactly what – it's like the hot seat thing is just kind of annoying. Just do it or don't do it, you know, and they haven't done it yet.
You're just mad because you have to record a podcast with me after that one ends. We have to stay and watch the whole thing before we
yeah,
come,
man.
Before
we start recording the podcast. I love waiting up with you. I love waiting up with you. You act like I'm not going to be watching it anyway. To me, I don't know.
The only game on. That's Pac-12 after dark, homie.
I misspoke, bud, and I got to apologize. UCLA is not my Texas of the West.
USC
is 100% my Texas of the West.
Well, USC and Texas are basically the same program. There's been one coach in the last 40 years who's been successful there, and everybody's tried to recreate that and not managed to been able to do it.
All while having every single possible resource made available, correct, imaginable to that program. I still think that Texas, correct, has a higher ceiling than USC. But both teams are in a very talent-rich area. Both teams are the most recognizable name. I guess Texas is kind of a 50-50 coin flip with the ascension of Texas A&M. And the fact that Texas A&M has become a very good football program has been kind of tough for Texas. But they both live in the state that is basically supporting the entire conference. And they both have been successful in the past, and when were they? I mean, they played in the national championship game when both were at their peak. Like, that was peak both of their teams. And I just, like, I don't know if it's just because that was my childhood or because I was like 19 or 18 when that was happening.
Oh yeah. And we just always, like, romanticized things, I don't know, that happened when we were 18 or 19. Can't imagine
so,
why.
Yeah. So maybe that's just the thing that's stuck with me. But when you look at things from a recruiting standpoint, I just view them both as teams that have every possible ladder to success if they just do it the right way. And I don't know that Clay Helton has proven that he can do that. Even though the recruiting has taken a tremendous turn for the better, I haven't seen a single thing on USC's schedule the last few years in terms of on the field that would make me think, hold up, wait a minute.
Yeah, and that's the problem. We'll be right back after this message from one of our lovely sponsors.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
I wanted to get into this with you. This was a question I got for my Dear Andy column, but it was based on this person listening to us talk about this stuff. And so I'll read you the question, and you've already read my answer to this, so we can just start talking about it. It's Dear Andy, given the top-heavy talent distribution that is always discussed on the podcast, I thought it would be interesting to ask who you and Ari Wasserman would take in an actual, quote-unquote, all-star game of sorts. The rules of the game would be that you get to choose the players and coaches from the top four teams that you decide on. Example, Alabama, Ohio State, Georgia, and Clemson. The other person would have the choice of players and coaches from all other teams. Obviously, the talent could or could not be comparable or equal depending on your view, but maybe the coaching would be the difference. For example, Saban as head coach, Kirby's defensive coordinator, Ryan Day's offensive coordinator, etc. Who would you choose? What would the line be? Is that different now from 5, 10, or 20 years ago? And obviously, if you wanted to choose a different four teams, that's fine. But I thought it was an interesting thought exercise slash discussion to see how far as the four-team playoff has highlighted the top-level talent distribution even more than before, which I agree with. And oh, by the way, this is from @Azul18 on Twitter. Alabama, Ohio State, Georgia, and Clemson just happened to be the top four teams in the 24/7 talent composite in 2020. So
that's the best teams in the sport were the top four teams in the recruiting rankings?
It's amazing how that works.
It's insanity. Okay.
So to do this, I was thinking about using current rosters, but that will require quite a bit of projection on my part with younger players at Clemson and Alabama and all those. You know, I could pick older players from all of the other ones who've established themselves and make it pretty easy, but there's a lot of projection. But
before you reveal your team, we didn't both pick teams. Andy just did it because I think we'd get bogged down with too many names and it'd be confusing if we both listed teams. But I wanted to ask you, and I think it's important to discuss, when you initially read this question, who did you think would have a better team? Like, what was your – before you did the exercise, what were you anticipating finding?
The others, the field, just because of sheer numbers. The same reason more 3-stars get drafted than 5-stars, because there's so many more of them.
And then like, what did you
so
find?
So many more chances.
Yeah, you're right.
I still feel that way. I feel like this is a modified – could Alabama beat the Jets question? But there's a little bit of a difference. We can talk about that because the reason the Jets would always beat Alabama is there are 3 or 4 guys in Alabama who aren't going to be NFL players, and the Jets would just pick on them mercilessly, and the Jets would win by 4 touchdowns. In this one, there are no weak spots on Team Superpower. They're all NFL players. But the thing is, because I have so much more to pick from, with team field, they're also all NFL players, but probably better NFL players.
I think if you take the best players, and how many years did you go back when you did this?
I did the last 4 drafts. So all of these guys, except the guys just drafted, have played some in the NFL. So it's the 2018 through 2021 drafts.
When I first heard the question, I thought the field would be better because there's just more options, like you said.
Yeah,
and everything you said about the 3-star prospects.
The spread is a lot closer than I thought.
I think the spread is a pick.
And the reason for that is Team Superpower's defensive line is unbelievable. And if you have a good D-line, you have a chance. Team Superpower's offensive line is pretty good, but I got guys playing out of position to get the best 5 athletes on the field, which I didn't have to do with Team Field.
Okay, run down your list.
Okay, so let's do Team Superpower. This is Alabama, Clemson, Georgia, Ohio State, from the last 4 drafts. Your quarterback is Trevor Lawrence. I started Najee Harris and Travis Etienne at running backs. You can argue this if you want. You want to put Nick Chubb in there? You want to put J.K. Dobbins in there? Fine, go ahead. They're all good. I'll take any of them. Wide receiver, I had Devontae Smith and Calvin Ridley started. Again, you want to put Jerry Jeudy, Henry Ruggs, T. Higgins. You want to put any of those guys in there, feel free.
Listen, the fact that you have guys on the bench is just an illustration of how absurd this is.
It's crazy. And it really drives home the point of how lopsided the talent distribution in college football is. So offensive tackle, Andrew Thomas. I had to move Isaiah Wynn to guard. I got Landon Dickerson at center. And that's really only because Billy Price hasn't really established himself as a starter in the NFL. And he was a first.
But these are the college. We're doing this based on the college versions of these players.
Yeah, kind of, but also what they wound up being. I mean, it's a game. If they played now, what would happen? Jonah Williams, I got at 1 guard. I moved him to get the best 5 on the field, and then Jedrick Wills from Alabama is my other tackle. Irv Smith is my starting tight end. the defense, this D-line is disgusting. Chase Young and Nick Bosa are your defensive ends. Quinnen Williams and Christian Wilkins are your D tackles. Oh, by the way, Deron Payne can just rotate in one of those spots. And Dexter Lawrence can rotate in one of those spots. Cleveland Furl can rotate in at defensive end. It is a murderer's row. It's crazy. So that one's unbelievable. I ran a nickel just because there's so many good DBs as well. But I had Isaiah Simmons and Roquan Smith as my linebackers. And then in the secondary, I had Jeff Okuda, Patrick Surtain, Minka Fitzpatrick, Xavier McKinney, and Denzel Ward. But there were a bunch of other guys I could have chosen as well.
I don't care what the other team is. What can you even say against that?
The other team's really freaking good, Ari.
No, I know, but that team. Yeah, go ahead. Just go with the other team, and then we'll talk.
Okay. Coaching staff, by the way. Coaching staff of Team Superpower. Head coach Nick Saban. Offensive coordinator Ryan Day. Defensive coordinator Kirby Smart. Quarterbacks coach Brandon Streeter. Offensive line coach Doug Marrone. Running backs coach Tony Elliott. Receivers coach / recruiting coordinator Dabo Swinney. Defensive line coach Larry Johnson, linebackers coach Brent Venables, secondary coach Kerry Coombs, and special teams, I got Mickey Kahn from Clemson. Okay, let's move on to team field. So, yes, that team I just mentioned is really good. That's a really good team.
Yeah, and also with the team field, too, you also have to take into account that you're picking off of really, really good rosters. Like, you have Oklahoma available to you. You have Florida available to you. You have Notre Dame, Oregon. And if you take the best players off of the second tier teams, there is a lot to choose from. But, you know,
I feel like if we added Oklahoma and Notre Dame to this, it would be completely even. Like, if we added an Oklahoma and Notre Dame to Team Superpower, which is terrible for the sport, that those six teams equal the other 124.
Bro, LSU is on your list.
That's true.
If you put LSU, Oklahoma, and Notre Dame in Oregon, you wouldn't even have a game.
It'd be over. All right. So here's our quarterback dilemma already on team field. Our two potential starters are Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen. If we'd like to go into and figure out who the backup is, it's Baker Mayfield, Justin Herbert, Kyler Murray or Joe Burrow.
I think Lamar Jackson is the choice there.
I think you're probably right. And I think you can do, but I would do some crazy stuff where I either had Lamar and Josh Allen or Lamar and Kyler playing together at the same time.
Oh, so now we're doing a quarterback by committee type thing?
No. On the field at the same time.
And Lamar Jackson. I will say this right now. I think Lamar Jackson is the best college football player of the last decade.
He was amazing. He was when you look at the talent around him and what happened to Louisville afterward, I think it tells you exactly how good he was.
Also, the most exciting, which kind of gives him the heads up too.
Can you imagine if he played with the talent that they had at Alabama or at Clemson or you could put him on, a second tier team and they would I don't know, because Kyler Murray was essentially as exciting and dynamic as Lamar, and they still couldn't beat Alabama. So you still have to have a defense. But all right,
yeah.
Here's the rest of team field. Your starting running backs are Saquon Barkley and Jonathan Taylor. Your starting wide receivers, I mean, I went all LSU. I could have gone very deep here. Ja'Marr Chase and Justin Jefferson. Penei Sewell's your starting left tackle. Quentin Nelson's your starting left guard. Frank Ragnow's your starting center. Wyatt Teller's your starting right guard. Tristan Wirfs is your starting right tackle. The guy who started at right tackle for the Super Bowl champs, by the way. Kyle Pitts is your starting tight end. Oh, by the way, I still have Noah Fant and TJ Hawkinson on my bench at tight end. Like, I might go three tights this game. Yeah,
in non-goal line situations.
Yeah. My defensive ends are Bradley Chubb and Brian Burns. My defensive tackles, and this is why I'm not as good as that line is for Team Superpower. I'm not sure you can run a play when you got Derrick Brown and Vita Vea on the same defensive line. That's pretty nasty.
Insanity.
Linebackers, Darius Leonard, Devin White, Tremaine Edmonds. Corners, Jair Alexander, Carlton Davis. Safeties, Derwin James and Jesse Bates. That's a really good team. And favorite of the podcast, Matt Campbell is our head coach. Lincoln Riley is the offensive coordinator. Pat Fitzgerald is the defensive coordinator. Dan Mullen is your quarterback's coach. Mario Cristobal coaching the offensive line. Mike Loxley coaching running backs and the recruiting coordinator. Receivers coach is James Franklin. Defensive line coach is Ed Orgeron. Linebackers coach is Luke Fickle. And your secondary coach is Mark Stoops, another favorite of the podcast. I still got team field in this one, Ari. I got team field by a field goal.
Can I say two words?
Go for it.
Nick Saban.
That's the other part I was worried about. I knew you were going to say that.
I don't know. I think this would be the greatest thing in the history of television.
I would love this game so much.
And I wish we could do it. Yeah, no, I don't care about how good players are in the NFL for this exercise. I think that there are great players who are just great college players that don't project well to the league. And I think for the exercise, I would view them based on how good they were in college. And listen, everybody on this list is good in the pros too. I'm not saying that, you know, but you know, like even Lamar Jackson has translated extremely well to the NFL, despite the fact that people thought that he wouldn't.
Josh Allen is better in the pros than he was in college, probably.
But I think this would be a pick 'em.
Oh man,
you have what you've done is you've created two teams without a single weakness.
the depth is absurd on team field, though. That's the problem. If somebody gets hurt, if you get the wrong guy hurt on team superpower, you got a problem. Team field, it doesn't. They just come in waves. Like,
yeah, what these teams from team superpower do in the real life.
In real world, exactly. And that, I think, that's why I really appreciated the question, because I think it really does illustrate just how lopsided things are. You and I talk about it all the time. We hope things will get better, that they'll be different. We don't know if they ever will, but I really hope they do, because this part of that's not fun. Like, knowing that that team superpower exists, like when Alabama plays a lower tier SEC team, that is team superpower playing a normal team. And it's boring.
It would be very interesting if we only did it off of this year's rosters.
We could. That's another thing we could do. I mean, we could have some fun with it.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think the team field would win that game, but I think it'd be a good game. I think if you
team
did it
superpowers
just
superpowers quarterback is who is it going to be? DJ Uiagalelei?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or JT. What about JT Daniels?
I would go DJ just based on what we saw last year in the Notre Dame game.
All right.
Yeah. But the wide receivers, I think you just put Ohio State's wide receiver room there.
Yeah.
You know, what did you do for those exercises? Did you just go to the first round drafts of the last 4 years and just like pick players off the first round?
I use the draft history for the superpowers. And then I use first rounders, all pro teams, all America teams and stuff to populate team field.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's like funny because I think that if you did it just on this year's roster, you might have a good game. Depth obviously comes into play with the way that football plays out. It's just a very physical game.
Who are you starting as your quarterback on team field using only this year's roster? Sam Howell?
Probably Sam Howell, yeah.
That's the interesting thing. I think you build probably a little bit better offensive line on team field. I think you build a better defensive line on team superpower, which again, that explains a lot. That just explains how this works. Because like I said, when I introduced team superpower, if you've got a good D line, you've got a chance.
Yeah. I guess like Keaton Slovis might be, Michael Penix maybe, Desmond Ritter.
Rattler. You can have Spencer Rattler on team field too.
Can I say something? I saw Malik Willis in person at the opening, and that guy is built like a 6-year NFL veteran.
Yes, he is. He's very athletic, and his arm is off the charts good.
You know, he might be somebody. De'Arik King, Matt Corral.
I think Malik Willis.
It'd probably be Spencer
Corral
Rattler.
It's either Howell, Rattler, Malik Willis, or Matt Corral.
Yeah, I
Matt
mean,
Corral
I just, I
because
think
of the I like Matt Corral's fearlessness. Because he has to play Alabama, and he has to play similar talent level when they play LSU. he's seen it. Like, he's not going to be scared. And you know he's not scared. He'll throw the ball anywhere.
Yeah.
That's sometimes the problem. But no, I think he would be completely fearless. Although Sam Howell, I think, would be fearless in that situation too. So I really, golly, that would be fun. It would be so much fun if they could just let's do this before camp starts. Let's play this game.
Forget the combine and the Senior Bowl.
Yeah,
let's build the list with the benefit of watching them play through the entire season. Forget the combine. Assemble these two teams and let them go at it and play a real game.
I think the scouts would love that.
How much do you think that the viewership for that game would rival a big regular season game? Do you think the viewership would rival that, like Georgia Clemson?
As long as they didn't play it like the Pro Bowl. As long as they were serious. And if draft spots were on the line, if they felt like, okay, I'm going to get dropped or I can move myself up.
These teams 3 weeks to prepare for it.
Yeah, I'd watch that instead of the Senior Bowl.
I might watch that instead
of the National Title game. I'm sorry, Jim Nagy. I don't mean, please continue to come on the podcast. But
oh, my God. I would be at that game, and I wouldn't be in the press box. I would be in the front row with
maybe
the shirt that says Stars
maybe
Matter.
That's how they should do the Senior Bowl.
Yeah, man. That's what I just said.
Yeah. No, but I mean that. Yeah, make that the format. Okay, I'm with you. All right, we'll call Jim Nagy and see if we can get that switched.
The question
up.
Is whether or not you could convince Trevor Lawrence to play in that game.
Not a chance. Can you imagine Trevor
Lawrence played in games they shouldn't have played in already?
Trevor Lawrence would want to play in that game, and his agent would tie himself in front. He would tie himself to the nose of the plane to make sure it never took off.
That's so funny. That's so funny.
Oh my gosh. All right. Before we let you guys go, we need an up. We're going to do a little update on Ari's adventures in adulting. That may be our new. We need to have it like a jingle for that. Ari's adventures in
adventures
adulting.
More failures in adulting.
I think you're doing fine. The wallpaper's up. I saw the photo. It actually looks good. Now, I was thinking when you first said wallpaper, the more traditional glued on wallpaper, which is just nightmare to take off. They do have the stick on now, and that's the kind you got, which is its own kind of nightmare when you're trying to deal with ripples and all these other things, but at least you can get it off fairly easy. But whoever you guys hired to put it up did a magnificent job. The nursery looks spectacular.
So let me tell you guys, when we first got this wallpaper, I don't think either of us had any idea the difference between stick-on and roll-on or whatever you just said. I thought they were all stick-on. And we had somebody come over, and the surface of our walls, there are two types of surfaces where you have completely flat walls with no drywall on it. And you have other types of walls that there are patterns in the drywall.
Textured. Yeah.
Textured drywall. My house is textured drywall. It looks nice. And somebody like me would walk into a room and never notice the difference between regular, just flat drywall and that. But we had the first person that we had quoted to come put the wallpaper up came into the house and looked at the wall and had a literal meltdown. She could not have left the house faster. She said, I can't do this. The texture makes this impossible. She goes, you guys made a big mistake. You should return this if you can. And just left. And I was just like, oh my God, you can't return wallpaper on a wall that we measured in order to get this the right size. So we had to get somebody to come in and look at the wall, and they had to detexturize the wall. And this is like a 3-day thing because I had to come in and I don't know what they did. I removed myself.
At least you didn't have to scrape popcorn off a ceiling. That would be worse.
No, we didn't. Our house was built recently, so we don't have popcorn on the ceiling. But this person had to scrape the texture off the drywall and then reapply drywall on top of it to make the wall flat. And this was like a 3-day exercise, and I was downstairs while the person was doing it because it gave me anxiety. But when it finally was finished, it turned out great. And it looks great, and there's no bubbles, and it seems to me that it'd be super simple to peel it off. And the cool thing I like about the wallpaper more than anything is that it doesn't look like an infant wallpaper. So as our daughter matures in age and becomes a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old, they would still fit a child's bedroom. So I think that we will either sell the house with that wallpaper up, or we will keep that wallpaper long enough for the for our daughter to enjoy it into her early teens at the latest. So
yeah, or when she's one and a half, she just tears it down while she's careening around the room. Just
that could happen.
Just be prepared for that. So
it was more expensive than we thought it was going to be, but there was no issue in applying it because we didn't have to do it.
Would have cost a lot less to paint that room, and you could just paint it.
Probably
again.
Would have, yes. But I don't think
whatever.
Neither of us considered the fact that the textured wall would make it harder. And that's like the problem.
It's always
you own a home, it's thinking about things that you wouldn't ever consider.
Right. And the thing is, when you've owned a house for 10 years, those things will come to mind. It's just that it's the surprises, and then you've got to write a check, which are incredibly frustrating.
That's exactly what happened. Yes.
I remember my first house. It's like, wait, we got to do that? What is that? Wait, that costs what? And you just have no idea what things are supposed to cost, what can happen if you do this, like what the chain reaction is if you do this one thing. And yeah, so you're moving along. Now, you've told us about your adventures cutting the grass for the first time. And look, we all understand you didn't get to cut the grass as a kid. You grew up in Arizona. But one of our listeners, Claire, wanted to send you in a story to make you feel a little better about how tough your first grass cutting experience is. Because you've gotten back on the horse, right? You've gotten back on the mower.
Well, the thing that I found out after the fact, because I jokingly put up a video of me cutting it, and everybody's like, why is there a bag on the back of your lawnmower? And I was
Which I said before you even cut it.
And I will say that the worst part about mowing your lawn is bagging the shavings.
Yeah, that's why nobody does it.
I've gotten back and mowed my lawn without it, with the mulcher piece on the back of it. And it makes it infinitely easier and far quicker. And now I feel like I've conquered how to mow my lawn. Now, the second thing that I've got to figure out is I have a weed whacker that takes the same battery as my electric mower, which is something that everybody else was making fun of me about too. Mm-hmm. But I think I hit the weed whacker too close to the fence, and the wire on the end of the weed whacker snapped. So I have to reapply more string to the edge of the weed whacker, and I couldn't think of anything I would rather
re-spool
not do. Re-spool it.
There are YouTube videos for. There are YouTube videos for every weed whacker that show you how to re-spool them.
I want to give up lawn care completely because the thought of doing that is so daunting. It makes my stomach turn.
Don't do it. You watch a 3-minute YouTube video and you'll figure it out. Do not be like our friend Claire. Let's hear Claire's story. I guarantee you, you're gonna feel better.
Hey, Andy and Ari. After the random ranking of worst household chores and the continuous encouragement of Ari as he tries to adult, which, let's be honest, we're all just trying, I felt like y'all needed to hear my inaugural grass cutting story. So this is Columbia, South Carolina, circa 2001. I was probably about 10 years old, and my dad decides that this random Saturday in July was the day that I needed to learn how to cut grass. So he takes me outside, shows me the self-propelled lawnmower, tells me how it works, and leads me to my own devices for 10, 15 minutes, and then comes back outside to see what I've accomplished. He comes out, and everything is zigzag, looks a little cattywampus, and he is livid. But what he fails to realize is that the handle of the lawnmower and I are essentially the same height. I can't see over the handle, much less tell whether or not I'm cutting in a straight line. I'm just looking at my feet thinking, hey, I walked across grass that was cut. I did a good job. Oh, no. He was highly displeased. Everything was terrible. He sent me inside and said, I've had enough. You're not being a team player. You're not even trying. And so that was the first and, yes, the last time that I ever cut grass. Side note, my family still to this day thinks that I was just being manipulative and did a bad job on purpose so I wouldn't have to cut the grass, but that's not true. I'm just short.
Claire's dad thought she would, at 10 years old, cut it like the groundskeeper at Wrigley Field.
Claire got off easy. Thank you for the encouragement, Claire, and I'm so happy that she never has to go through that again. I wish I would have. It would have been a brilliant thing for me to completely mess up on purpose, and my fiance would tell me to hire a landscaping company.
Claire's dad ruined a potentially great lawn mowing career by being mad that she couldn't carve the mountains into the grass like they did at Coors Field for the All-Star game last week.
Claire,
you don't expect a 10-year-old to do that.
Multi-million-dollar landscaping business went out the window that day.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's a good lesson for me because, you know, my son is about to turn 12. He is right there on the verge. I let him use the chainsaw to cut something the other day. I let him cut a little branch with the chainsaw while I was doing some other stuff with the chainsaw. I might turn him loose on the yard here in a bit. Probably pretty soon. Probably should have already done it, but it's definitely about that time. But I've got to remember, I can't pull the, well, I can just do this better myself in 10 minutes and kick him out. I got to show him how to do it. I got to teach him to fish. Yeah,
you have to do it again.
I can't give him a fish. I got to teach him to fish.
Yeah, or you could teach him how to pay for somebody to fish for him.
I don't think that's a good lesson, Ari. I think that's a pretty terrible life lesson.
You know, well, I feel like the house is almost furnished. We got the couch coming in soon. The nursery is completely set up. I built the crib with the help of my parents. I built the swivel
and the
chair.
Allen wrench.
Yeah, and the Allen wrench. We bought a dresser that was as easy as just clipping the drawers back in. So that room, which was the one that was giving my future bride the most anxiety, is completed. So we are
You got the glider? Do you have the glider?
Got the glider. Yeah. Oh my God. Woo. The glider was another story. Maybe I'll tell you that one next week. I don't want to. My fiance
I can't wait till you try to sell the glider on Craigslist when your kids get too old.
She was, she's 4'11". So she's a small person, and trying to find a glider that she could sit in comfortably with her feet touching the ground was a battle. And I think it's the cutest thing in the entire world because the entire point of having a glider is the ability to use your feet to rock the chair. And like, her size was a real problem, and it turned into a whole thing of going to multiple stores during COVID to try to test these things out. And the ones that she thought were cute for the nursery weren't in stock. And it was a whole meltdown of how are we going to get a glider that we know she'll be comfortable in. So we finally found one, but that was another adventure in the life of Ari Wasserman's growth as a human being. And, you know, another lesson of how to persevere and get stuff done. And now it's done, and it feels good that it's in the rearview mirror.
Give a man a glider, and his wife will glide for a day. Teach a man to glider, and she'll glide for a life. I think that's how that goes. I'm so proud of you, Ari. I can't tell you.
Thank you so much for the... I mean, I'm surprised we're still talking after such an elegant close.
No, we're done. We're absolutely
done.